April the 9th, 2004, and today we're visiting with Ned Harrington. Gene Fowler has joined our group, and we're going to talk about Cartersville and Ned Harrington's relationship to Cartersville and how he came to live here. So if you'll go right ahead and start, tell us how did you get to Cartersville? Because you didn't, weren't born here.
By accident. My sister-in-law had a friend who had bought a nice little house in the country for a summer place. Florence was a widow in New York. And Florence found soon after a place she houses. We heard about it. And we came trying to find Cartersville. And when we found the place on an old, miserable March day, my wife, who was 7 months pregnant, came in the driveway with me and looked at this place and said, "Oh no, no way. Forget it." Well, I said, "Let's just buy it on speculation." We did. Years ago, when the house was sad, it was decayed, and I went to work on it. I would commute from where we lived in an apartment in Philadelphia, commute every day to this house and work on it, while Wilmer Wood and Jake Basie did the building of this room in which we are sitting now, this wing of the house. I was working on the old part, trying to make it livable, while they built this. And Wilmer Wood had been, he's a local man, he was a wonderful man, and he had worked on this place for the previous owners, the Myers, who were in the farm to the just above us, and they had sold it to Florence Fairbanks. So Wilmer and Jake Basie did the carpentry while I worked on the old house and supervised and took the architect's plans that my sister-in-law's father had drawn up for us and redesigned them to what we thought would look right. And I said to Wilmer, "Let's put the roof lines on so that they match the old roof lines." We did, and Mr. Hillard had a fit because we changed these plans. So it goes. And in 1948, we moved here to this little renovated house in a jungle. Now, strangely enough, a gentleman came with this property. His name was Arthur Basie, and he was Wilmer Wood's brother-in-law, had married Laura Wood. And I just seemed to have inherited Arthur along with the property. He was doing a lot of work for my then neighbor, the former owner, Mr. Meyer, up above. And Arthur just took me over. And sometimes he'd get paid and sometimes he wouldn't, but he was just a piece of, belonged to the property. And at this, about the same time, very early in the first few months, a little dachshund that belonged to Jonathan Meyer up there started visiting us. And he seemed to like the handouts. So the dachshund adopted us, and Mr. Meyer said, "Oh, you can have him, keep him."
What was his name?
Ludwig.
Oh,
Ludwig. Luddy.
Of course.
And he was a bastard.
Oh.
He'd bite you as soon as look at you. And he lived with us for 16 years of a love-hate relationship. Finally died of a heart attack. I think he was exhausted from running down the hill and visiting with the ladies, young ladies of the town. That was his avocation. Now, the reason this room in which you are today was built, this wing on the house, was for a soil analysis laboratory. That was my planned profession. Of course, everybody said I was crazy, but I was determined to go into the business of doing soil analysis. And this was the laboratory. It was built for that purpose. That big door was made purposefully to let the machine or the equipment in and out. There's a winch at the end of that doorway. So I got started in the soil analysis business and advertised in all the local publications. And to everybody's surprise, including mine, I did a fairly good business. Built up a good trade. And had several young ladies working here in the laboratory as assistants, technicians. And after a while, I found developed a sideline of water analysis. Just people asked me, well, since you're doing my soils, can you test my water? I didn't know a thing about water testing, but I learned. And next thing I knew, I was doing as much water testing as soil testing. And at that time, I had two ladies who worked here. And one of them became famous in this neighborhood. She was Pat Michener, who lived down to the foot of the hill. And Pat, I snatched her practically out of high school and trained her in the trade of soil analysis, and then she and I grew into the water analysis business gradually. And in 1955 came the famous flood, which changed my life, because the demand for water analysis was so great following that flood, I was literally flooded with work. I had to put on extra help. I put on Pat's sister-in-law to come and help. I changed the name to Water Analysis Services. I sold the soil analysis business to a friendly competitor, and from then on did nothing but water and wastewater. I had no idea, but the flood changed my direction. Now, meanwhile, Arthur and I tackled the jungle and started to establish some law and order outdoors. We cleared fallen trees and chopped down poison ivy, vines as big around as your arm. We uncovered the big steps at the foot of the hill, which were the steps to the original buildings that were here. We found the stream through the forests, and little by little we put the place in order. The orphanage, which was in the front yard, which was a huge five-story building, had been torn down 8 years before we came here. It had gone to pot during the Depression, and nobody had the money to do anything with it, and a speculator had it torn down for the materials that were in it.
Can you give us a brief history of the orphanage?
Well, that would go back to 1859 when the Excelsior Normal Institute was built under the guidance of Elizabeth Stover and Isaac Stover going along footing the bills. And other ladies of the town were involved, but they wanted to build a high school so that their sons could have a place to be educated rather than to be sent elsewhere. So they acquired a little tract of 7 acres, which is where we are now, with an old house on it, and they built a huge 5-story stone school building and a large frame auditorium and other buildings, a barn and outbuildings, two 8-hole outhouses, for example. And the Excelsior Normal Institute was a going concern, and it lasted from 1859 to 1873, when competition from other schools began to weaken the situation. And it folded. And William R. Evans, one of the trustees and a tycoon of Carversville, bought it and reestablished the premises as the Hillside Home, a summer resort. Then it became a year-round resort. And for the next 20-some years, it hosted people from all over the world, but mainly from New York and Philadelphia, summer people. And it was a famous resort. We have pictures, many pictures of the resortees and the goings on, and the large frame building, which was back of where we are at the moment, was called the hall. And they had dances and Chautauqua ceremonies and all kinds of religious services, you name it. That hall was used for everything. It had a pool table, bowling alley. It's quite a place. So the school, or the resort, lasted until 1894. When it folded, the competition was getting too much. The mountains and the seashore were starting to take over the summer resort business. And it was acquired for sheriff's sale by John Robbins, a speculator from Morrisville. And he only lived 4 years, and he never lived here. But his widow, Nell Robbins, moved here with her two sisters, Kizzy and Sally. And Nell died, and Miss Kizzy was the queen of this property for almost 20 years. She held parties here. She owned not only this big building and this house where we are, but the farmhouse up above us. She owned the whole works. Until 1922, when she just decided it was too much. Miss Sally, her sister, didn't have all her marbles and wasn't much help. So Miss Kizzy sold out and moved down to a house in the village. She lasted until 1939. I'm sorry that I never had a chance to know her. In fact, she lived in half of the house where Arthur Vasey, my right-arm man, lived. Now, in 1922, the Christian Church bought the premises and established the Northern Christian Orphanage. And it was a going concern for the next over 20 years, until the late years of the Depression, when it just got to be economically impossible, that orphans were dispersed and the building was empty and desolate. And that's when a speculator bought it and had it torn down for the materials that were in it. But fortunately, amen, the house was not included in the destruction. And that's what we bought. The original house was 1762, but that was only a peanut. And when the Excelsior Normal Institute was built in 1859, this house was enlarged. A second floor was put on, and that's what we bought, was the enlarged from the original house. Now, when Arthur and I were fighting the jungle, he stopped one moment and stood and sweated and swore at his scythe and his axe and said, "What we need is goats." Well, I didn't know a goat from an elephant. But we went to Rice's sale, and we came back with 6 goats in the back of my station wagon. We had fenced the place reasonably well by that time. Of course, a fence means nothing to a goat. If it decides to go through a fence, it'll go through. Anyway, the goats went to work, and they did a magnificent job of clearing the brush. Not only that, but they ate the bark off the walnut trees and everything else within 12 feet of the ground. Amazing reach. But they were my friends, and I had goats for a number of years. And then along about, goat time, a customer gave me a young lady donkey named Marilyn. You can understand the era. And the backside of the donkey matched another backside. And Marilyn came and became a character. She kind of sort of took over the place. And after a couple of years, we bought Marilyn a husband whose name was Stonewall Jackson. And there were little Stonewalls. And then I bought some more donkeys. And I ended up, over the years, with a herd of about a dozen donkeys. And the goats were still here. They got along with each other. And then my next-door neighbor by that time was a gentleman named Bill Brandt, and he had to move to South America because of business arrangements, so he had the place up for sale, his farm, which is above us, and Bill Brandt had a flock of sheep. And like a fool, I went to the sheep, to the auction of the property, and the sheep were part of the auctionees, and I was stupid enough to nod my head at the proper moment and found I owned a flock of sheep. So for some years we had donkeys, goats, and sheep. Believe me, that was a handful. But I was young and ambitious at that time, and I did it all. Now, by the way, going back a little bit, while I was working on the house, Lou Wilson, who was some kind of a relative of Arthur Vasey and Jake Vasey, everybody's related to everybody else around here. Lou Wilson was a retired farmer, and he came and he did the painting. And he had a wad of putty in his back pocket about the size of a pailful. And when he'd come to a hole in the wall, he'd just stuff it with putty and paint over it. So half of the outside of this house is still made of putty that Lou Wilson stuffed into the walls. And somehow relative, Nels Michener, an elderly gentleman, used to walk up the hill from the town and watch me work. I didn't know all these people. I was a stranger. Since then, I've gotten to know them, know everybody. So Nels would hang around and give me advice till he died of old age, not too many years after that. And then I got to know Henry Wendy, who was the postmaster, and Henry and I became good friends, and he often came up here and visited with us, and he was also the town barber, $2 a haircut, and Henry was retired in due time, and his son Roger took over for a while. And Henry had married Cynthia Quinby, and the Quinbys were a big family around here, and they were related. Well, Lou Wilson's wife was a Quinby. You can't begin to untangle the connections among many of the families in this village. And I'm finding that I'm related to a bunch of them. The Livesies are my cousins. And the Tinsmans are my cousins. And so it goes. You keep turning them up. Mm-hmm. I never knew this, but my mother was descended from an old Quaker family down around Newtown. And when you were related to one Quaker family, you were related to them all.
What was her maiden name?
Her maiden name was Pilling, and her grandfather, Pilling, had married a Jenks from Newtown, from below Newtown, mm-hmm. ran the Jenks fulling mill. So, and as I say, when you get descended from one Quaker family, you find you're descended from them all. The interrelationships are fantastic. It's a wonder we aren't all a little bit nutty. Byron Quinby, Cynthia's brother, was a farmer. He was the manager of one of the large farms around here, owned by Warren DeLong. And when Warren started selling off his property in his old age, he gave Byron the house that's across the road from us. And thereby, Byron became my neighbor. And Byron was related to all these people and to the Klings and the Wendy's, you name it.
It's the
driveway. I'm going to go on.
Go ahead. I just see a wonderful white cat.
And Mr. DeLong owned the house across the road, which he shortly thereafter left to his farm manager, Byron Quinby, and Mr. DeLong had a windmill. And one time, Mr. DeLong was taking a bath, a shower, and the water failed. And he got so mad at that windmill because it wasn't pumping water fast enough to suit him that he said, to hell with it, and installed an electric pump. I knew about all this. And I kind of wanted a windmill. Mm. I don't know why. So I said to Warren DeLong, you don't want that windmill anymore. No, I don't. I wish the damn thing would go away. Well, it went away. Young Bill Taylor and I disassembled it piece by piece, brought it up here, built a base for it, a concrete flooring, and piece by piece reassembled that windmill, which is right out behind us in the yard here. I don't know how I ever climbed 50 feet up a steel ladder and worked on that windmill, but I did, and I had the darn thing running. I had it pumping water for a few years until a storm came along and ripped the hell out of it. I gave up at that point. But anyway, I got my windmill for free. Now, among the town characters, I'm going to digress a little bit. Doc Brugler was a veterinarian and somewhat of a people's doctor at the same time. That was commonplace. He lived across the road from us for a while, and then he moved down to a house in the village. This is before my time, but I'm telling you something that I've heard off the grapevine. Doc Brugler hated animals. He was a vet, but he hated any animal that was not his customer. And he had a reputation for poisoning dogs and cats and beating cattle and horses. He had a bad name. He was an arrogant so-and-so. And it is said of Doc Brugler that when one of the girls who were the servants in the hotel, the Carversville Hotel, found themselves in trouble, they would go to Doc Brugler and he would make the necessary adjustments. Mm-hmm. Quite a character. And then this house across the street, later in our era, became owned by George and Dorothy Shaw. George was a nice guy, kind of a windbag, but a nice neighbor. And we got to know the Shaws quite well. And one day, Dorothy called me and says, come over, I need help. I stopped what I was doing and went across the road. And here was George, stretched out on a settee, dead as a mackerel. Oh. He had come in to rest from working on the outdoors, lay down on the settee, and his heart gave way.
Mm. How old was he, do you know?
Oh, George was not too old, 50-ish.
Ooh, that is...
And I had the duty of calling his daughter, who was somewhere outdoors, and telling her, giving her the news. Dorothy hung on there for a number of years after that, managing the place by herself until she sold it. She just couldn't handle it.
Is that where the parsonage is? Is that
what that's what's called the parsonage? Yes,
oh, wow.
Because Dr. Hunsicker, who was the superintendent of the original Excelsior Normal Institute, lived there. That they had built that house was built by the same people who built the school as a home for the superintendent of the institute, the principal. And then he acquired it in his own name after that, and he became the Presbyterian minister who had the little Presbyterian church built up the road from the Carversville church. And that's why Nina McKissick named it the parsonage. She got her years a little bit mixed up, but we don't worry about that. She's she was close. Now down the road, at the bend of the road, below Bar and Quinby, lived Doc Haney. And Doc was a chiropractor. And in the mornings, he was a pretty good chiropractor. In the afternoons, he was stoned. He drank his lunch, and he was gone for the day. So people who needed services knew to make a morning appointment. And one day, I was working in the attic. That's when we were still, I was still working on the house. It was in the late 40s. I was doing something in the attic, and I really put my back out, which everybody does from time to time. And I was in agony, and I went to Doc Haney and told him about my back being out. And he listened, and he said, look out the window there. I want to show you something down by the bridge. And I, like a sucker, followed his gaze and looked out the window. And whammo, something hit me in the back. And Doc said, you're all right now. Go on home. And he did it. He cured it in one blow. Doc Haney had a reputation. He had a girlfriend named Marion. And he would go staggering downtown to the post office and the store. And I remember Cynthia Quinby sitting on the porch of the post office one day, watching Doc Haney stagger down the across the bridge. And she said, these old guys, they reach too deep. Yeah, Doc was a cheerful character. Now, Aaron Overpeck, who lived down at near the corner, near the stop sign, was a tinsmith, and he was a pack rat. He had his shop down near the corner of the square, and Aaron was a character, and he would come up here, and he would talk my ear off. He was the father of Clarence and Harvey Overpeck, whom some of us, well, Clarence is still around. Harvey has risen, I'm sorry to say. Harvey was a good friend. But Aaron was a chatterbox, a character. And during this era, would be in the 1950s, same era, Walt Livesey was still running the grist mill, the Stover Mill.
In Carversville.
In Carversville. He was still running it as a grist mill. I used to go down and buy my donkey feed from him. And he sold it and closed it down and sold it. And it became a residence after that. But I can remember the farmer's trade coming and going to the grist mill. And I can remember one day, Jim Wood and Joe McGill, Jim Wood worked for Walt Livesey, and Joe McGill was one of the customers, were having one hell of an argument outside, out in front of the mill. I don't know what the argument was about. That doesn't matter. Walt Livesey came out and said, hey, you two guys are deacons of the church. I don't want to hear this. Whatever the argument was, he settled it. Now, we all remember Charles Hargens, who was a magnificent artist who lived up at the corner where the, opposite the elementary school. And Charles Hargens not only was a great artist and a great friend of everybody's, but he ran the scout troop. He established the scout troop in Carversville and ran it for a number of years until others took over. Of course, the Nichols family is now firmly in charge of the scout troop, but there have been others in between. But we all remember Charles Hargens, and he lived and thrived, outlived his wife, and lived by himself. We had a girlfriend, and died at the age of 103. That's not many years ago. But there's a gentleman that this town will never forget. And I can remember Harry Foster, Pat Michener's grandfather, and Agnes Foster, who lived down at the close to us in the town. And Harry, as far as I know, never had a real job. He's one of these mysterious people that lived on air. Agnes was a retired school teacher. She was the teacher of the Cold Hill School up above us in Plumstead Township. And it is said that Agnes taught most of the Pollock kids English, brought them up as good Americans. She did a great deal for them. Agnes was a wonderful old lady, and she survived to a good old age. Now, as I told you, this was an orphanage from the 1920s until 1939. The orphans were dispersed, and in the 1980s, when we started having Carversville Day, I managed to contact several of the former orphans and invited them to Carversville Day. And next thing I knew, I was having an open house on that day. It was every September at that time, and entertaining a slew of former orphans who were about my age at the time. And I developed a whole new association of friends among these orphans. I'm sorry to say that I'm one of the few survivors. I was an honorary orphan.
What?
They lived on your property.
They had lived here, and of course I kept my ears open, and I learned a great deal about this property from them. And in the late years of the orphanage, Miss Nellie Scyther was the manager. She was only a few years older than the orphans themselves, but she had come to be the housekeeper and graduated to the job of being superintendent of the orphanage. The kids loved her. I mean, she was almost one of them. And when I had these reunions, we found Miss Nellie out in Lancaster and imported her. And for several years, Miss Nellie would be part of the afternoon's gathering. I got to know her well, and she was a hell of a nice person. She's 93 years old. She lives in Illinois at this time and still with it. The orphans came from various broken families or non-families, you might say, in New Jersey and in around Philadelphia and in Bucks County. They were mostly kids of mothers single mothers, I think we call them today, who just couldn't handle them. But they grew up to be great self-reliant citizens, wonderful people. I'm really grateful that I got to know them all.
Quick question. Was the orphanage sponsored by a particular church?
The Christian Church.
The Christian Church.
The head of the denomination, the denomination to which our church belonged, or belonged in those days.
Okay.
Of course, it's United Church of Christ today, but that's a fairly recent development. But this was one of the Christian churches, founded in 1837.
I don't want this to run out. When that bell rings, I'm going to turn this off, and we're going to flip this tape, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it was the organization of the Christian Church which acquired this property for an orphanage. They had been looking for a piece of land with buildings on it that they could use. And they heard about it and bought it.
Whose decision was it to keep the steps, those famous steps?
I don't know, but I bless them for having, kept them,
because
it could so easily have been destroyed.
Mm.
Those steps were in bad shape when we took them over, and Arthur and I rehabilitated them once we cleared the forest off them so you could find them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They are exquisite.
And we've taken good care of them ever since. They're a landmark.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when this house, this property, was declared a historic site by the Conservancy, they fought me on the idea of the house being the focal point. But the steps were there, and they said, we're going to base our decision to give you a plaque and declare you historic because of the steps.
Yes. Good.
I fought Margaret Ritchie on that, and I won. Wasn't easy.
No.
Now, among the superintendent of the orphanage in its early days, the 1920s, was Dominic Johnson, a minister of the Christian Church, who was a miserable personage. Nobody liked him. I don't even know why Mrs. Johnson liked him, and I'm not sure she did. The kids didn't like him, and he served here for about 4 years, and the board who controlled the orphanage called him onto the carpet because there were rumors that he was molesting the young orphanage ladies, propositioning them. And due to this examination that they put him through, he resigned. He thought it was a good time to get out. But when our kids were younger, they and we, as individuals, my wife and the two kids, at different times would say they heard noises in the living room at the middle of the night. And that mystified me for a while. Finally, I put two and two together. And the story is that Dominic Johnson used to bring the kids into this, what is now our living room, which at that time was a washroom, a wash house, and beat the hell out of them with his leather belt, punished them. So what we were hearing, I have concluded, was Dominic Johnson's ghost moving the furniture back, furniture which we had put in his way, so that he could get at the kids.
Oh. With that, I'm going to turn this tape over.
Okay, this is a good time.
So we don't hear that. I'm going to turn this tape over. And this is...